It would be really easy to turn this into a scary show, but it's scary enough on the face of it. We have no idea what's going to happen with pests and predators due to climate warming, but it's not likely to be to the advantage of an environment that supports us. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we begin to probe the changes our ecosystem in Alaska is beginning to see. Call 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org with any changes you have seen in insect and predator behavior on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
They were here with the dinosaurs, and they're here with us, and they'll probably be here with us. And then we'll probably be gone, and they'll still be here. I'm talking Beatles, and I have with me the author of Empire of the Beetle, Andrew Nikiforuk, by telephone from Calgary in Canada. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing just fine, Steve. How are you?
I'm scared. I'll tell you, just frankly, this whole issue, the closer you look at it, you realize, oh, geez, this is something I really didn't want to look at, but... As you probably know, Andrew, we had a beetle infestation that just devastated forests here in Alaska, and now we are seeing basically beetles that attack evergreens and other things that have spread all over the Northwest, and I guess getting down even into the high country and in the Rockies.
Well, it's quite a phenomenal story. I mean, it's an unprecedented outbreak, and that in many ways started in Alaska as Alaska warmed up in the 1980s and 1990s and exploded throughout southern Alaska and into the Yukon. And then we had a massive mountain pine beetle outbreak in British Columbia and all the way down the Rocky Mountain West through Montana and Colorado. And as well, then we had a massive outbreaks of Ips beetles, all related, in New Mexico. That really took out a third of the pinyon trees in New Mexico. So we've had a phenomenal change in the landscape. We've seen over the last 20 years, perhaps the death of 30 billion trees, conifers, all conifers, whether it be spruce or lodgepole or ponderosa pine or pinyon trees, white-barked pine. And this has really changed the landscape and watersheds and fire regimes, carbon sinks, logging communities. This has been a history-making event, really, in the North American West.
Well, of course, the first thing that we thought about when the beetle thing started here in Alaska is, geez, why has this gotten so bad? It's not like there weren't always beetles. In fact, the beetles have come and decimated large amounts of forests before. But... The scale was bigger, and people were saying, well, what is it? Is there something anthropogenic? And there was some thought that maybe like some seismic lines that had been cleared that allowed them to like get some nurse logs and do like that. And then I guess the ultimate answer that came out was that, well, the climate has just warmed, and these bugs are doing well in the warmer climate, that they reproduce more. They go through, I guess, in Alaska, what they found is that they got two hatches out in a season, which is like a hell of a lot of beetles, buddy.
There's no doubt the climate really, really affected the beetles. I mean, beetles are, and most insects are really sensitive to climate change, much more so than politicians. And so they were really able to increase their numbers on the landscape, reproduce better, in the absence of cold winters. But people forget that climate change also really affected the trees. And, the white spruce and Sitka spruce in the Kenai Peninsula, I mean, they just got thoroughly drought-stressed during this huge epidemic. And what's fascinating is that you find the same phenomenon wherever the beetles really exploded. Drought-stressed lodgepole pines in British Columbia, drought-stressed pinyon trees in New Mexico. So everywhere the beetles exploded, you not only had warmer temperatures, warmer winters, hotter summers, drier conditions all around, but you really had trees in a state that were incredibly stressed out. And what this meant, is that trees have really good defenses. They're like castles, right? They're well defended. You've got bark, you've got resin, you've got all kinds of hydrocarbons that you can use to assault attackers. But when you're drought stressed, you can't make a lot of resin, and your defenses are down. So there's another advantage to the beetles. And the beetles, they are doing what they are designed to do. I mean, they are forest engineers. They are designed to thin and weed and prune our forests, but they have done so on a scale that we've never seen before, thanks to the climate change trigger, but also thanks to other factors. I mean, fire suppression has played a role in the sense that, we have a lot of even aged stands of trees throughout the West because we've been, we regard both bark beetles and fires as forest managers we don't want in our forests. And there are a number of things that we have done that have really made these infestations much worse.
Well, I want to go right to the title of your book because you pushed a button there. The title of the book is Empire of the Beetle, and you honestly mean it. I mean, are you saying the beetles are going to take over? I mean, you talked about them as being forest managers. I mean, come on.
Well,
these are bugs.
They are. That's what they do. They go in, and especially, spruce beetle and spruce trees, they have a very profound role to play in an aging spruce forest. They'll take it down, they'll collapse it, and begin a whole process of renewal. Same thing with mountain pine beetle and lodgepole pine. Exactly the same kind of function and role that they play in those forests. And if you don't allow fire to renew your forests, then insects will renew them on their own time scale and in a time frame that's not convenient for us at all. And when I talk about the empire, again, this relates to climate change because we have seen the beetles going further north. We've seen the beetles going into higher altitudes than they've ever gone before. We've seen the beetles go into forests that we never ever thought we'd find beetles there because it was too damn cold or too wet. So the explosion of bark beetles in the Yukon, there's no record of bark beetle activity in those forests for the last 300 years. That was totally an expansion of a beetle habitat that climate change made possible.
So
these guys are, they are going to change our landscape. And what's interesting, what scientists, you had a phenomenal guy in southern Alaska, Ed Berg, who did tremendous research on the spruce beetles. We don't know how much of this landscape is going to come back as it normally was, again, due to climate change. When you ratchet up the temperatures, you make it harder for certain species of trees to return. In the case of southern Alaska, you've got this explosion of Canadian grass where amid all this spruce beetle kill. That's making it hard for spruce to young spruce to generate in that sort of environment. So we really are seeing our landscape transform our very eyes. The same applies to lodgepole forests in British Columbia or Colorado or pinyon forests in New Mexico. In New Mexico, you had a pinyon juniper forest, two trees that grew together, amazing kind of synergy between the two of them. And the bark beetles just took out the pinions altogether. So now you just simply have a juniper forest where you once had a pinyon juniper forest. So, and scientists really don't know where this is all going. There's a hell of a lot of chaos and uncertainty about what's really taking place on the landscape. And it's a really powerful story because it's a story about small, improbable characters on the landscape, in this case, bark beetles, who are, taking out very mature, complex, aging forests which have a certain amount of instability and vulnerability to them. They're like aging financial systems that are really concentrated, and you know, and you can spend billions and billions of dollars trying to prop them up, but in the end, they, you know, you can't stop this process of collapse and renewal. And renewal is a pretty uncertain business with climate change.
We're speaking with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Empire of the Beetle from Calgary. And the book is out now. Now it hasn't been out all that long, and he's been doing the speaking tour and the publicity tour for this book. And it's great to have you with us, Andrew. I recall, must have been 83, maybe 84, when this guy by the name of Ed Holston of the Forest Service said, we got to have a press tour. And they organized, they took a whole bunch of us reporters out onto the Kenai Peninsula, and we just... He's pointing out along the way, he says, now see those red trees? That's beetle kill. They're just, the first they're red and then they're gray. And then I knew that was the first thing I saw. And then the second thing is we just pulled over and he went over to the edge of the spruces there and he started looking around. He started poking at the bark. He said, ah, there's pitch out right there. See they're getting that, see that hole there? And then he started pointing to these holes and you can see the holes where the pitch came out. He says, now if you get enough beetles, they won't be able to pitch it out. If they're under water stress, they won't be able to pitch the beetle out. But a few beetles they can handle. He says, now let's look around. And he finds this log lying down on the forest floor. He says, okay, now I'm going to show you. This is a nurse log. And he takes a little hatchet and he pops off the bark. And he says, those are the galleries. And it was an empire of the beetle, just like you're saying, Andrew.
Yeah.
It was an empire of the beetle. And he says, now there's going to be a hatch come out of a log like this, and it'll just go in and all these trees over here, and if there's too many of them, they'll just overwhelm them. And that's how he explained it. And then, by golly, everything he said happened. I mean, it was scary. I mean, we've had terrible, scary forests on the Kenai Peninsula. We put all kinds of money into fuels reduction there. You can go, I was just around Hope last weekend, and the landscape is totally changed. The spruces are, I mean, it's just gray. Whole hillsides are just gray. All the spruces are gone. And it's huge. It's a huge thing, and the ecosystem has changed. And we don't know where it's going to go next. So it's all become very fascinating. You were giving me some really interesting statistics on the sheer biomass of these beetles when this thing got going in Alaska.
It's pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, bark beetles are predators, right? They do prey on trees. And you've got to think of them perhaps in the same way you think of, you know, as killer whales or wolves, because they attack in swarms. And they're very... very carefully orchestrated attacks, and so it's all a numbers game. And so they'll bring down a tree with sheer numbers, but only the numbers they need to bring down that tree.
Wow.
Now Ed Burke, who is an ecologist, you know, and was, you know, working in Kenai during while this all happened. So yeah, I mean, he put together some fascinating figures. So here, they're about 32,000 ounces in a ton. And it takes about as many as 10,000 spruce beetles to bring down a tree. And so there, you know, there were approximately then on that basis, there were, you know, near close to 20,000 tons of beetles swarmed over the Kenai for a decade.
20,000 tons.
20,000 tons of beetles. So that would be like encountering a pod of 3,300 six-ton killer whales swimming over the forest, you know, or finding a mega wolf pack composed of 500,000 80-pound members. So that's extraordinary.
And at least their teeth are smaller.
Their teeth are, I mean, we're talking about critters that are the size of a mouse turd or a rice kernel, and their power comes in numbers and in their very calculated attack modes.
Well, now you're talking
they're
about
very social animals.
The empire of the beetle, but how in the world would they know? Okay, this is enough. We don't need to send another platoon.
Well, they communicate with chemicals and our pheromones, and these chemical perfumes, they have a particular chemical perfume that when they are attacking a tree, they send out that brings more attackers to the tree. And then, I mean, and they'll actually use the tree's own chemicals to produce these perfumes. And then they'll send out another perfume that tells other beetles, hey, guys, the tree is full. That's it. The attack is over. Go somewhere else. And then once they are in the tree, then they use a totally different form of communication called stridulation. And that's where they actually scratch body parts of the beetle to make very distinct sounds. And they're almost like, it's just very hard to describe the sound of bark beetles within a tree.
Damn it, and here we are, we're radio. We should have got a recording.
And there's a fantastic recording. It's called The Sound of Light in Trees by David Dunn, who's a New Mexico musician who's recorded the sounds of pinyon and ips and western pine beetles in pinyon trees. Absolutely extraordinary.
Wow. Man, I'm telling you, Andrew Nikiforek, I have never felt more like Art Bell than I do at this moment. We got this guy Art Bell on Lower 48 Talk Radio that is always talking about alien abductions and such like that in the middle of the night. It's all very mysterious. The stuff that you are telling me is all absolutely true and documented and scary, and just as scary as any of the stuff that Art Bell talks about. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide. An Anchorage call comes in on the regular line at 550-8422. Please email us talk@alaskapublic.org. And we go to Valdez. And Guy, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Guy.
Thank you, Steve and Andrew. Very interesting. Hey, I want to talk about, Al Gore had his 24-hour web thing. I didn't get to see any of that because I'm not really computer literate. But what I think, these climatologists have been doing wrong in trying to explain this against versus, the oil companies and the coal companies and the atomic energy companies is that, they've been just talking about climate when they should be talking about, informing people also about the acidification of the oceans and then these dead zones that are materializing out there everywhere we have a river. And, we got that University of Fairbanks doing this acidic study out here.
Oh, yes. We've had Jeremy on the program.
Well, one of the things I want to know, Steve, is, they're starting to study the oceans. But, I sit here and I think about this. If we've increased the ocean level, I've read, from 30% to 25% in 300 years, what I'm wondering is, why isn't anybody starting to study the soil and this, because it is ending up, this acid rain is coming down on our land too, and it's not all dissipating and going out into the ocean. It's
Guy, one more, into our water. What's that again? What in the water?
The acid rain.
Oh,
it's,
I see.
Working down to our water table. It's had 300 years to start percolating down there.
Guy, that's bunk. I'm sorry, Guy, but that's just bunk.
Well, how come the acid level is building up in the ocean, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be building up on the land.
No, it doesn't work like that, Guy. It condenses
it
and all like that.
Yeah,
no,
it does.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does, Steve.
You can't have it. You can't have it.
I'm going to predict that, these coming
Hello? Did we lose him? I think we lost Guy. Oh, man. That was too bad. I was really scrapping for a fight there. But so it goes. Andrew Nikiforek is with us. He's author of Empire of the Beetle by telephone from Calgary in Alberta. Right up there in tar sands lands, Andrew. You've written a tar sands book, too. Even won an award for it.
That's true. It's a major industry here in Alberta, and a very controversial one at that. And it's another signature of the end of cheap oil when we have to dig up the boreal forest to make hydrocarbons to run our vehicles. So,
yeah. So that book won the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award. But holy mackerel! I started looking, and once you get down to your magazine awards, it's just you got a CV as long as my arm here, Andrew. It's interesting that you chose to go into the issue with the beetles.
Well, I mean, they're absolutely fascinating creatures, and they when they start moving and accelerating and have a much greater impact on the landscape, then that's Mother Nature telling us something. And they're responding to stress in all of these trees. You know, and the caller that, you know, he made a good point. He was trying to make a point about it's just not climate change, it's just not changes in temperature, but it also is changes in acidity in the environment, particularly in our oceans, as more CO2 is being dissolved in our oceans.
Big time, yes.
And, and trees are a critical part of that whole dynamic because they are carbon castles. They sequester carbon and they give us back oxygen. And when insects start removing more and more trees from the landscape on the scale that they have in the last two decades, 30 billion trees, which is absolutely extraordinary, you know, then they begin to have an impact on carbon cycles and oxygen cycles. And you're looking at something here that's pretty profound and pretty major, and that has really caught scientists by surprise.
The sheer masses, Andrew, are just really sobering. You have one tale in a book about a guy that starts picking up weird stuff on the weather radar and realizes, holy mackerel, these are beetles.
Well, we've had some amazing swarming flights in British Columbia. And this was in Prince George, British Columbia, right in the interior, and it's high plains, lodgepole country. And there was reports of these incredible shadows on airport radar, and you know, at first the guys at the airport thought, well, this looks like a rain cloud or something, and you know, or and you know, you look outside and the sun was shining, so they went to investigate, and there was a scientist from Prince George who went up in the air in a small plane and 300 feet to 1,000 feet above the canopy of the trees, he was capturing beetles, and what he found was that in the space of an hour, there were enough beetles traveling 300 to 1,000 meter to 1,000 feet above the tree canopy to kill something like 1,500 trees every hour. I mean, just extraordinary numbers, and so we had some massive flights of beetles that actually went over the Rocky Mountains and into northern Alberta. And similar flights happened in Colorado where you had beetles, you know, rising from forests in Colorado, traveling, you know, 300 miles and then dropping into pine forests in Nebraska.
Man, I mean, it's just... That is scary. I mean, I'm not saying it's like a sign of intelligence or anything like that, but still, this is a type of behavior that is just leads to very, very wide dispersal. And you wonder, well, now, if they exhaust their prey, obviously their numbers are going to drop again pretty fast.
And they basically eat themselves out of house or home, as you know, everyone in around Homer, Alaska knows. I mean, the beetles left when more than 80% of the trees, mature trees, were dead, and same thing in British Columbia. You know, that as soon as they've eaten themselves out of house and home, 80 to 90% of the lodgepole are now dead in the interior of British Columbia. Then they're gone, and we probably won't see them for another 50 or 60 years until we have a whole mass of mature trees again on the landscape. I mean, the amazing thing about bark beetles is that they go from zero, they almost go from endangered species on the landscape to, you know, these huge, unbelievable swarms that can get caught in people's hair and can sort of, you know, and blot up airport radars. You know, they go from zero to nothing in incredible short periods of time.
Well, now is the time. Thanks to the internet, I think we've tracked down that recording that you were talking about. So I'm going to see if the technical staff can mix it into the show here. So, Andrew and Nikki Forek, what are we listening to here?
We're listening to the sound of the bark beetle. We're listening to bark beetles stridulating inside, in this case, a pinyon tree in New Mexico, and all those kind of clicks and stuff that you're hearing, that's the beetle. You can also hear perhaps some wind and some water movement in the tree. It's a phenomenal recording.
Wow. It sure is.
and you know, and some of these species, they can, you know, they've got, I mean, it's almost like music. I mean, they can make a variety of sounds, and we don't know what they're all communicating with those sounds. We know that there's a mating call. We know that there's a warning call. We know, you know, there's all kinds of sounds that these creatures are capable of. I mean, in some ways, we almost need to think of them a bit like ants or termites. I mean, they are highly social creatures.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. We're talking about some of the stuff that's happening in the ecosystem as the climate has been warming. And as we're seeing, one thing that happens is that precipitation patterns change. Forests get less water than they used to. Temperature goes up. Forests get less water than they used to. Their defenses go down against the beetles, and the beetles take over. They have an empire of the beetle, according to our author, Andrew Nikiforuk, on the program today. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. Email talk@alaskapublic.org if you want to call in with some of observations you might have. I think anybody who was in Alaska as this beetle thing started had no idea that it was going to sweep the continent as it now has. And indeed, it makes you wonder if there's other, you know, this is just the beginning. Now we'll see other insects having uprisings.
Well, I mean, this is the really interesting thing about this. Here we're talking about just one particular insect that has a very important and pivotal role to play in forest renewal. And look at how they responded to, you know, 1 to 3 degrees changes in temperature. And we know that there's a lot of other creatures out there that are also responding in their own way. And there's been a lot of insect activity, not only just in the forests in Alaska, but throughout the Rocky Mountain West, that has affected other species, such as aspen trees in Colorado, where we have the phenomenon of, you know, sudden aspen die-off, which we know that it is related to drought stress, but also to the activity of 2 marginal bark beetles that were never considered a problem. And so
wow. There's
a lot going on in the woods, and we don't really understand it all.
No, I'll tell you one thing that we you may not have heard of that we had here this year, Andrew, and that was the geometrid moth, and probably some other conditions either, but it really caused a problem with a lot of the places where people customarily go to pick berries. And they just went, there weren't any. Yeah.
Well, I'm a landowner, and one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I've lost a lot of trees in the last couple of years, and the real forest killer in my neck of the woods was a spruce budworm, and it was attacking Douglas fir on my property in southern Alberta, and I had a quarter section. And I have both lodgepole and white spruce and Douglas fir, and we just had this remarkable outbreak of spruce budworm. And they don't directly kill trees like bark beetles. I mean, bark beetles just hammer a tree, and it's like having, you know, 500 to 1,000 bullets hitting a tree, or putting in 500 to 1,000 nails into a tree, and then you get that tree then quickly dies. But with spruce budworm, will eat the buds over 5 to 6, 7 years, and then you will slowly have tree death. And it's a creature that is very much associated with forest renewal in eastern spruce forests. And, I mean, they'll literally take out huge, huge areas over time. But they are, again, very much driven by climate. So we've had no cold winters. We've had really hot summers. And we just had an explosion of spruce budworm.
All right. I want to thank you, Andrew.
Taking out mature trees.
I want to I hope you'll stay with us for the second half of the show. Can you stay on the line?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you.
Okay, that's really wonderful. It is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Alaska ecosystem and especially pests and predators as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The climate's changing, and we all know we've got to adapt, and human beings, you would think they would be very adaptable, but they're nothing compared to predators and insects. We're talking about the Alaska ecosystem in detail today on Talk of Alaska. We spent the first half hour with Andrew Nikiforuk, author of The Empire of the Beetle, and we now turn to Bruce Wright. He's a scientist now with the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association, but with a long, long background in Alaska with, the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA. Bruce, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there, Bruce.
Bruce, I'm so glad that you were a very busy man and hard to find, but you did write a book, you're glad to come on and talk about it, Alaska's Predators, Their Ecology and Conservation. And maybe you can just briefly characterize what you were doing with this book. It's like, it's not quite a field guide. I couldn't go out in the field with this probably. But if I wanted to prepare myself for a trip to somewhere, I probably would want to read this if I was interested in natural history.
It's not a field guide, but it does provide information that I was hoping would stimulate people to become interested in predators and understand predators, and also understand that they have an important part to play in ecosystems. And some people think of predators as strictly competitors with humans, but in many cases that's not true. But in fact, they tend to help stabilize ecosystems and provide a certain level of balance that wouldn't be there otherwise. They're a pretty valuable component of stable ecosystems. And they're also really interesting animals. So I've been studying predators since graduate school. That was a long time ago. And coming to Alaska, we have lots of predators, all different kinds in the ocean, on land, birds, just tons of them. And they're all playing their part. And this book kind of went through a broad range of predators that I've had an opportunity to work with and study, and so I had a little bit of insight into how they operate and presented that in the book. So if somebody's interested in walking in the woods, they might want to read about some of the avian predators, and maybe they'll be lucky enough to see one, and it'll give them a little bit of understanding of how important that animal is and how interesting it is.
And how they might differ from some other, say, bird of prey, and some of the feats that they're capable of that you might be able to see, but would go by so fast that if you weren't prepared for it, you wouldn't see it.
Right. Last week, we have robins moving through now in their fall migration. We live out here in Palmer, and last week we had a goshawk in our little wood lot that we have. And my wife was out working along the edge of the woodlot, and this goshawk had landed right next to her. And she, you know, she had an opportunity to observe it. She's read a little bit about goshawks in the book, and so we have predators all over the place. And with this book, if people read it, they'll have a little more understanding and maybe glean some enjoyment about predators.
I think there's very little doubt of that. Among the predators you've got in here is the sea star, and I want to get into that in a little bit here. But first, let me see if you would agree with Andrew Nikiforuk that insects can be predators.
Well, certainly. And I mean, Nikki said that the bark beetles are predators on plants, on trees, and I agree with that. What I was curious to hear about from Andrew is are there predators? You would think there would be some predators that would be taking advantage of these spruce bark beetles, like woodpeckers. But are there some predators out there, or even diseases that could be considered a predator? But diseases that might exert some kind of control over these insects, or do their populations blossom too fast for that to control these animals, and they just get. It sounded like the main control was they just ate themselves out of house and home.
That was the main control, Bruce. I mean, whenever you have a major spruce beetle outbreak, I mean, it's like a slow moving hurricane. You know, it's unbelievable. And yes, it becomes a real Christmas for woodpeckers. I mean, you'll have an extraordinary number of woodpeckers and other birds working on these trees that have been attacked by spruce beetles. You also have lots of other beetles, in particular claret beetles, that prey on bark beetles. So, I mean, there's a whole glorious jungle of other predators that are working on the beetles. But when they emerge in the numbers that they did in the last two decades, I mean, it's an avalanche, it's a flood, it's a hurricane or a tsunami, and you know, the work that these other predators do is just minimal in terms of control.
Wow.
I see, but what's interesting about this is that it changes the whole system in that you get a suite of other animals that didn't have a prey base, and now they have all these beetles. So the woodpeckers and these other predatory beetles move in, and then they have their own predators. Woodpeckers have predators. The predatory beetles have predators, probably birds and spiders and things. And so your whole system shifts to a different type of system, and a different suite of predators, and it ends up on a different trajectory. So that's pretty interesting.
You bet it is.
It's a whole landscape transformation. That's what the beetles sort of author. And I don't think there's any other creature on the planet that can change a landscape as completely and as quickly as swarms of bark beetles.
Oh, I don't know. Bruce may have some other ideas about that.
Well, human beings, I guess. I mean, we have to put human beings up there, but right. I mean, we're certainly landscape modifiers in a huge way.
Yeah, but you just take when you get to the marine area, for instance. I mean, holy mackerel!
That's a whole other world. Yeah.
What an orca could one orca can do. For instance. Okay, let's go to Charlie. Joins the program from the Anchor Point area. Charlie, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. I'm sure glad you're having this program to kind of further this discussion. I was one of the first people that blew the whistle down here on the Kenai about what was coming with the spruce bark beetle. I had run into these beetles down in New Mexico in the 1950s and in Montana in the 1960s, and it scared me enough that I thought that we needed to come up with some kind of mitigating factors in order to try to stop this outspread. And then what HGA did, I agree that it's stressed out trees. That's who the beetles work on, the old stressed out, really old trees in the forest. They take them out and new ones come along. But it's also, if you supply them with unlimited food in the near short distance from where they fly out of the trees in the spring, you're going to have problems that you wouldn't have if you didn't provide them with all that down wood. But the question I really want to ask you guys is, I tried to blow the whistle on it early on, Julie Cesarini and I, down here in Homer, and tried to get something done about it. There was no money, there was no interest, finally we got Mike Navarre to help, and we did that demonstration clearing up in Cooper Landing to take out the diseased trees and see if they could save some of the trees. But then after that, nothing happened. But now there's millions and millions of dollars being spent and being done on it after the fact. And I think maybe this relates the same way to our forest fire fighting syndrome or whatever. We don't put out the small fires anymore like we used to. We let them get to be million-acre fires and million-dollar fires before we go in and try to put them out. And that's when they cause all the damage. And thank you for pointing out this information that you have and your authors and your people on there today. It's really, really interesting. I think wildfire is another thing, another destructive force that's kind of like the beetle invasion. And maybe we should be trying to figure out what to do with all these wildfires that are destroying everybody's homes in America.
Well, I mean, one of the problems there, as you probably know, Charlie, because you seem pretty knowledgeable, one of the problems there was that we let the forests, by stopping fires too much, we created fire situations. We got too much fuel in there.
Well, all right. What you've got to do, you have to manage the forest. In my family back in Norway, we've had a timber farm in the family since 1300, and you manage it, and you don't let it burn up. And you, when you take stuff out, you take the brush out, and you make it a fire safe place. That we used to do that in this country. We had, and in fact, that might be what we need to do to get everybody back to work again, is get the old CCC camps back going again. And those people cleaned up the forest and built the forest roads and made them nicer so people could drive on them and enjoy them and put themselves back to work after the Depression.
Yeah, Charlie, I want to thank you very much and pose that to both members of the panel here. Bruce, you've had your hands on both the scientific and the public policy area, and Charlie brings up a really interesting issue in that if resources had been developed earlier, we might have been able to not necessarily contain this pest. I don't think that would have been possible, but it might have been possible to at least keep it deflected and defend some stuff that we know was valuable to us.
I think this is more of a question for Andrew, but I don't think at this point we can stop, you could stop an outbreak that's well established. And you might be able to save a few trees on a particular lot. But even people that try to do that have problems. So when you have these huge outbreaks that are driven by big things like climate change and global warming, there's not much that we can do.
Andrew?
I agree completely with Bruce. I mean, what history shows, when you look at previous epidemics, whether they were in Norway or or other parts of British Columbia, or the experience has always been the same. As one entomologist told me, he said trying to stop a massive beetle outbreak is a bit like trying to stop a hurricane like Katrina by putting fans outside of New Orleans. I mean, you're not going to be able to do it.
Even levees don't do that much.
No, and so there's, we have to accept the fact that both fire and beetles are there for a reason. They're all part of the forest renewal process. And although, Europeans have been managing their forests much longer than we have, they've also had some major problems. I mean, when you take out most of your hardwood forests, as they did in Central Europe, and replace them with spruce and pine monoculture, then, you just had explosions of bark beetles every time there was a windstorm. And in many cases, pretty devastating losses of timber as a consequence. But that's because we overmanaged the landscape, and we didn't leave any room for the natural players. And it's taken us a long time to figure out that bark beetles can actually do a lot of good work, and so does fire, and that we have to leave a role for them in the forest. And when we take them out completely, we find that we're left with aging, complex conifer forests that are as bad as unstable and have no resilience even just like our modern financial system, where everything is concentrated, complex, and all but ready to collapse on us.
All right.
And there are very, very powerful, you know, parallels and comparisons between an aging forest and an aging financial system or an aging political system.
Wow. Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Empire of the Beetle. Also with us, Bruce Wright, author of Alaska's Predators, Their Ecology and Conservation. Let's go to Rika, joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. This is a great program. Andrew, you had mentioned earlier about the Canadian grass coming in and succeeding the lost forest. And I, being from Homer, I feel like we've been the epicenter of the beetle. And I'm seeing that, I'm thinking that you're referring to Calamagrostis canadensis. And
exactly
I'm seeing
it.
That
yep.
taking over quite rapidly. And I think by our actions of clearing the dead trees, we're actually enhancing and speeding up that aggressiveness of the Calamagrostis. The Kenai Peninsula has, through fire mitigation action, has been spending a lot of time and money on clearing the forests of the dead trees, and I fear that that only enhances the speed of the grass coming in, and I wonder if you could clarify that for me or shed some light on that.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, that is definitely what the research shows. And what's really interesting is that when the beetles come and they take down a spruce forest, and if you just let it be, you know, you will see the spruce seedlings come back and you will see the whole process of renewal take place. But when you go in there and think you got a mess to clean up, and you take all the dead stumpage out, then other things start to happen. And in this case, you've got this damned grass, which is one hell of a fire hazard, and which basically suffocates the landscape and really prevents any spruce from coming up. Then you've almost got a landscape that is then frozen in time. And is not going to make the transformation that the beetle sort of initiated. So, you know, it's almost a case of overmanagement. Now, I mean, and as you well know, coming from Homer, I mean, a lot of the dead trees did have to be taken down because, I mean, they were a hazard to homes, to power lines, and so on. But the clear cuts that took place, that's another issue altogether, and that was the way we dealt with all of this in British Columbia with the mountain pine beetle, and we have similar problems. I mean, we have these huge clear cuts and not a hell of a lot growing on them, but
that's
in forests
fear.
That
even
we didn't touch.
Our Bridge Creek watershed, I mean, the whole reservoir, the city and the borough have now taken it upon themselves to actually clear all the dead trees, and I think that's just going to worsen the situation rather than...
Yeah, you'll have a hell of a lot of soil erosion, and you'll have a lot of other problems, you know,
oh
and you'll
God.
Have much more water runoff, and you name it.
Wow, I get thank you so much for those geographic notes from Homer. Thank you for your call, Rika, and this just gets deeper and deeper. I'm trying to get up to the higher trophic levels, and instead people are sending emails. They want to know about blight as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Did you know Kodiak Island already produces about 90% of its electricity from clean, local, and sustainable hydro and wind power? Renewable energy, it's working for Alaskans. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project.
Beetles, beetles, and more beetles. And then you discover the pure mass of the bark beetles is such that it outweighs the, you know, huge batches of any sort of flocking animal. Just amazing. And we're talking about the Alaska ecosystem and some of the changes that are happening and how things have kind of warped up into a different phase. And we have Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Empire of the Beetle, and Bruce Wright, author of Alaska's Predators, The Ecology and Conservation. And I got to get this down into the ocean here, Bruce. It's all up with the insects right now, but I cannot let you off of the show without talking a little bit about sharks.
Okay. Because, yeah, we can talk about sharks. We have three primary species that that most fishermen are familiar with in Alaskan waters. There's the spiny dogfish shark. They reach lengths of about 3 feet. There's salmon sharks that get up to 7 to 8 feet long, 300-400 pounds. And then the Pacific sleeper shark, which can get up to, they've been reported up to 31 feet.
And why do they call that the sleeper shark?
Well, you know, a lot of fishermen used to call them mud sharks because they would catch them on their long lines, and they would come up and they would catch them on the bottom, from the bottom, when they were fishing for halibut or black cod. And the fish would come up, it'd be pretty lethargic, it might be covered in mud, they caught him in the mud, most fishermen thought that they actually ate mud and that they weren't much of a predator. That certainly tweaked my interest, being a predator guy, and so I started studying sleeper sharks, start off with their diet. And I was able to secure some of the sharks that fishermen had caught and that were dead, and looked in their stomachs, and you find all kinds of interesting prey items. You know, they'll go after just about anything out there. They'll take codfish, halibut, other sharks. What was really interesting is that these supposedly lethargic sharks, we found one with 6 adult chum salmon in its stomach, and these were pre-spawning salmon. So now all of a sudden this shark looks like it's a pretty good predator. What was really interesting also is we found chunks of marine mammal in this shark's stomach. So it's able to take, well, one had a couple of seals in its stomach. So they're pretty good predators. And back in the 1970s, when I was working for Alaska Department of Fish and Game, another shark appeared on the scene, and that was the great white shark. There was a few observations of great whites, and when I asked people about those, they thought that was an anomaly, not something that was normal. And I'm always interested in trying to disprove the existing hypothesis, which was that white sharks aren't normal to Alaska, and started asking around. And over the last 30 years, I've collected quite a database on great white shark sightings all up and down our coast around the Gulf of Alaska and into the small section of the Bering Sea.
Oh, man.
And they seem to be pretty common. And there's some places where you can regularly go out and have encounters with them.
But yeah, there are ecosystem implications to this, aren't there?
Well, I think so. And you know, one of the first things you think of is, okay, white sharks and salmon sharks are endothermic. They're warm-blooded. They use a lot of their calories to keep their body warm. They have what they call a countercurrent circulatory system, where their blood that's going to their gills warms the blood that's coming back from their gills, because when the blood passes through their gills, it cools off. So they recapture some of the heat that they make by working their muscles. And they use that heat to warm their eyes and their brain and some of their internal muscles so that they're good swimmers, better swimmers than a lot of fish, because their muscles are a little warmer. Their brains work a little bit better because they're a little warmer, and they have pretty good eyesight. And all they need are calories to drive this, and if they can find enough calories. In the case of great white sharks, they usually hunt big prey. And we have a lot of large prey animals up here. Some white sharks key in on large fish or even salmon. And some white sharks are really good at taking marine mammals. And I think it's like a lot of predators, they find or figure out which species they can take or which ones are successful in taking. And then I think they specialize in that. So some white sharks might take sea lions, and some white sharks might focus on on beluga whales. And yeah, that is a game changer. If you had a half a dozen white sharks that figured out they could take beluga whales and they moved into Cook Inlet, they could change the whole Cook Inlet beluga whale population pretty quickly.
And you're not saying they're not in there.
I'm saying that they are in there.
Whoa, man!
Yeah. So we have observations of great white sharks in Cook Inlet. We also have observations of two great white sharks taking a beluga in Cook Inlet about 20 years ago. So they're in there, and we don't know how many are there. We don't know how often this thing occurs. And what's really intriguing about this for me is that it's so difficult to get the data on these guys because they're so secretive. I mean, talk about stealth. You know, these animals don't have to come to the surface to breathe like an orca. And orcas are tough enough to study. You know, these guys can just be down there doing their thing, living their whole lives, changing ecosystems, shifting prey populations around, and we don't see it. You know, it's all down in a place where we can't get to.
Man, I thought the subject we'd exhaust this subject and we barely touched it, and the show was over. Bruce Wright, you have to promise to come on again sometime.
Sure, I'll come on. There's lots of interesting things to talk about with predators. They are affecting our oceans, and our oceans are affecting them. And the same thing's happening on the land. You know, you have the spruce beetles coming in and changing an ecosystem, and then your prey base will change, and then your predators will change. And we're seeing that. You know, we're seeing different changes in predator populations. And then right now it's September, and guys are out hunting moose. And so people are talking about, well, you know, there used to be moose out here, and now there's wolves. And so now a lot of people are talking about, you know, a lot of these hunters are interested in what's going on with wolves and moose, and what are the complexities with that predator prey.
So, you're willing to tread on that?
Sure, we can talk about that. You know, I mean, it's certainly controversial, but the book tries to stick with the science, you know.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We'll
talk about the science of wolves and orcas and Pictopodia, the sea star.
Right. And halibut are predatory. Thank you so much, Bruce Wright, author of Alaska's Predators. Andrew Nikiforok in Calgary, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
All right. And so next week, I think we'll try and look at one of those Sarah Palin books. Thanks so much to our crew.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.